So first thing, can you tell us your name, your position at the ECCC, and a brief summary of what you do there?
My name is Claudia Fenz. I am from Austria. I'm working, or I have been working at the trial chamber of the ECCC for 11 years now, first as a reserve judge and then as a regular judge.
Great. So you have been doing this for a while. You have 35 years of experience as a judge in investigation, trial, and appeals courts. And you've spent some time in other international courts as well. Can you tell us what brought you here to the ECCC?
Well, to back up a bit, I'll tell you what brought me into international justice, perhaps first, because the ECCC was, from my perspective, logical next step in an international career. I've always been interested in people in foreign countries, in traveling from a very early age onwards. I've actually at one time contemplated diplomatic career. Then I studied law. After my law degree, I interned in Austrian courts. And that's when I basically got the bug, if you want to describe it like that. So I decided I wanted to be a judge. At that time, that was a national career. We are talking the 1980s. International justice hadn't been born then. So I worked in the domestic system for close to 20 years. And then I think two things happened basically at the same time. First of all, in the 90s, international justice took off. Career-wise, after 20 years in a system, you are asking yourself, what do you want to do with the rest of your professional life? So suddenly the option that what I actually loved to do, and that was being a judge, could be combined with my original ideas on how my professional life should look, meaning going to foreign countries, etc., which is why I decided to look at options. And that's when I applied for a position in Kosovo. I then went to Kosovo in 2004, and it was actually in Kosovo on a Sunday evening when I came back from hiking with a couple of friends in a car that I got a phone call from Austria. And I was very close to not answering it because it was a Sunday, and yeah, but since it was from home, I did. And there was a colleague from the Minister of Justice on the line, and he asked me if I would be interested to work at the ECCC, which was about to be established at the time. And the process for judges was that countries put forward judges. And Austria was interested in doing that, and he asked me if I was interested in the position. And I said, well, 6 o'clock in the evening, I'm on a mountain in Kosovo, so when do you need my answer? And he said, well, you have until 12 o'clock tomorrow. So fortunately, the internet had been invented at the time. So what I did is I did a bit of research on what exactly the ECCC would be about. To be very clear, it wasn't the first time I'd heard about it. Obviously, all of us who had worked in international justice knew about new options coming up, new opportunities. So obviously I knew that it was in the making, but I hadn't really familiarized myself with the details. So I had a whole night or a couple of hours in the night to do that. And then I basically said, yes, put me forward. That's how the selection process started. And that's how many years later I ended up here, because eventually it took much longer to establish the court than was originally envisaged.
Can you tell us about the hybrid aspect of the court? What were some of the positives and negatives of working in a hybrid court here in Cambodia?
Well, that's difficult to answer so generally, because hybrid courts come in various shapes. Hybrid usually refers to both the composition of a panel or the court, meaning national and international judges, and the applicable legal framework. As I said, there are very different models out. Usually hybrid courts are envisaged in cooperation with countries who still have some capacity to try people, but who either lack the professional capacity or other reasons why they can't do it themselves. Now, the positive for the ECCC, to perhaps come to the ECCC, is a very hybrid if you want it like this, because not only has it benches composed of national and international judges, but also co-prosecutors. There's a lot of co's if you look at the language. Co-prosecutor, one national, one international. Co-lead lawyer, one national, one international. Co-lawyers in most instances, even a separate administration. So this is an extreme, even for hybrid courts. Now, this has advantages and disadvantages, generally the hybrid courts. Many hybrid courts are located in the territory of the partner country. This has obvious advantages, because it brings it closer to the people who have very often been impacted by the crimes these courts deal with. This has also been an advantage here, where through outreach, many, many people came and listened to the trials. It provides a kind of ownership, both for the judiciary of the country, at the ECCC, if you look at the trial chamber, also the Supreme Court, which are the most visible entities. The presiding judge is always a national, so it's an issue of ownership. Well, the possible danger for all of those courts is obviously, specifically if they are in the partner country, that for various reasons, political among them, the partner country might try to exert influence on the proceedings. And this was something the UN was very aware of when it came to Cambodia. There were year-long deliberations before the court was established. Much of it was about influence or attempts by the Cambodian government to exert or to ensure, let me put it like that, a certain influence over the court. Now, one of the issues was that the majority on the panels is Cambodian, so that would have meant that they could have outvoted the national judges at any time. That would have relegated national judges to fig leaves, and that's why we have this infamous supermajority rule. I'm not going into details here. Suffice to say, it doesn't work. So it doesn't remedy what it is supposed to remedy. It shouldn't be replicated in future systems. And well, in the Cambodian context, this concern about possible attempts to influence proceedings were certainly not put to rest by the very public statements of various politicians regarding various legally relevant issues, like, for instance, personal jurisdiction, who shall be tried before this court. Another issue for most international courts, but this includes also the hybrid courts, it's very practical now, is you're working in various languages. If you look at our trial chamber, the last one, we had one French judge, we had me, who was basically working in English, and we had obviously the Khmer colleagues, whose language was Khmer. Now, you need to translate and interpret. You need to translate thousands and thousands of documents, tens and thousands of pages. You need to interpret every court session. I remember times when we had a request in trial and we retired to deliberate, and it actually turned out that each of us thought we had heard a different request because the interpretations didn't work. So the more languages you have, the more time-consuming, the more expensive, the more potentially confusing it is.
Great. Now, thank you so much for the context on that. That's, I think, will be very helpful for people to know kind of the history of it. So Speaking about other challenges you've faced, can you tell us about some of the more significant challenges that you've faced as an international judge at the ACCC, besides the ones you just mentioned?
Well, since you emphasize international judge, I'll concentrate on the perspective of the international judge, meaning the foreigner to the country and the system, which also indicates where I see, I would say, three of the most obvious challenges: one legal, one cultural, and the last one is what I would call the personal challenge. Let me start with legal. The legal framework of the ECC foresees that the proceedings are governed by Cambodian procedural law. With the possibility to reference international law in certain circumstances. But the primary system is Cambodian procedural law. Now, there are two big legal systems in the legal world. One is the common law system, the other is the civil law system. They are quite different in some aspects, specifically when it comes to procedure. So I think it was probably much more difficult for people from common law systems to work in Cambodia, which has a civil law procedural code. Why is this? Well, it's a former French colony. France, as most of all of Central Europe, has a civil law system. It's quite interesting to know that when we came here and started to draft the internal rules, this is a procedural legal framework for the court, there wasn't even a domestic procedural code in force. So it came in force I think in 2007, if I remember correctly, and it was very much replicated the French procedural law, but old French procedural law. So anyway, this is a bit of background, but it is a civil law system. Austria has a civil law system too, not the same one, exactly the same one, but legally it wasn't very difficult for me to come into it. But for future courts, I think it's really important that people who are coming from other legal systems are trained or get an idea, get information about approaches taken by people from other procedural systems, legal systems. So the procedural challenge wasn't a big one for me. I had worked in hybrids before Kosovo. The Kosovo chambers were hybrids, so that wasn't very new. So on that front, I wouldn't say for me, and that's obviously always a personal issue, that wasn't a big thing. Now, culturally, that's very different. I think it might have been easier for me than for people who have never worked abroad, because I had worked in Kosovo, then in Palestine before I came here. Now, Kosovo is both geographically and culturally much closer to Austria, yeah, than obviously this part of the world is. Palestine was different. Here I had to work as a woman in a very different cultural background, in a male-dominated society, but for various reasons, very different culturally and legally. So I was prepared a bit. I was already open to new perspectives. But this country obviously poses new challenges. And let me just give you two examples to put a bit of flesh on this general language of cultural challenge. One from the working trial and one from the cooperation with national judges. I'll start with the cooperation with national judges. It struck me that there's a very, very different culture of discussion of legal problems. What we are used to from European backgrounds is, if you discuss among colleagues a legal issue, you throw arguments into the middle, test them, and in the end, hopefully the best argument wins. There are no personal winners or losers. It's about the arguments. And all the voices basically count the same. Now, in Cambodia, that's a bit different because you have a very hierarchical society. So it very much counts who of the people present is considered to be higher up and lower. That has an impact on the discussion. And the second issue is face keeping. It's very personalized, so it's not necessarily only an issue of the best argument wins, but who wins, which person wins. So this face-keeping issue is something you have to keep into mind too. Now, I have to say, and that was very interesting to see, that over the years, and don't forget, I've been here for 10 years, these different approaches actually merged into one very workable working environment. But it was something which was not easy in the beginning. The second cultural challenge, obviously opened in court. We are dealing with people, witnesses, civil parties, accused, who are coming from a completely different background. We know next to nothing, if you come from Western Europe, about the cultural background. You speak a different language. You don't know their body language. You don't know. To make a point, and I'm simplifying very much now, I usually say, if I'm in an Austrian court, I can basically tell most of the time when an Austrian crook is lying to me. I understand the language, I know why he avoids, how he avoids. I can understand body language. It's very simplified. Obviously, there are no rules to it. Here, I'm listening to a Cambodian via a translator, in the worst case, to a female Cambodian witness via a male English translator. So language is cut off. I don't know what body language means because I'm not familiar with it. So that's a big problem. I started to realize that in Kosovo, where I obviously had a very similar problem, and that cuts you off a lot of information you need for the evaluation of evidence, specifically when it comes to the credibility of witnesses, which is why I think one of the advantages of a hybrid is you have national judges who can supply this information, this additional information you need. Now, to give you an impression on how, well, let me put it like that. It really struck me how culturally different it is here when I first read the oath. This is an oath which is sworn by each witness that appears in court. And I'm not reading the complete oath now. But in the forewords, this oath invites, I'm quoting, all kinds of holy spirits and objects, such as the spirits of, and then there's a list of places, to come to preside over this oath. So the spirit world is coming in. It provides incentives to speak, to tell the truth, because it says if you tell the truth, you should be rewarded with good health, richness, up until a couple of generations. It also tells you what happens if you don't tell the truth. It threatens you with, among other things, execution, tiger attacks, etc. Now, the reason I'm mentioning this here is that I think this is a very, very foreign world. What it shows, this is an insight into a very foreign world for people from outside, but it is the world of the very people whose statements we have to assess, which I think why it is important to mention it. Now, on the personal front, obviously, those of us who came without a family, as I did, and without friends, are suddenly in a new environment. You have to establish a new network of friends if you're not a recluse, which I'm not. As a judge, this is not so easy because you're in an exposed position. There was a time when I was basically on TV every second day. Many, many people knew me. I always said if I want to misbehave, I have to take a flight out to a foreign country. Two-thirds of the personnel of the court was not available for social interaction because there were parties. You shouldn't be seen in public with parties if you wanted to avoid the perception of bias. So it's not necessarily an easy thing, but that comes with the territory, I guess.
Yeah, no, thank you for sharing that. I think it's great to get some of the different context on some of these various things that probably are affecting a lot of people, but not everybody has mentioned, so thank you for that. As you mentioned, this is not the first time you've worked internationally. You've worked in Kosovo and in Palestine as well. How would you compare your experiences there to your experiences at the ECCC? And I realize we've touched on this a bit, but are there any other similarities or differences that you would note?
I think the big difference is that in Kosovo, I was working in a post-conflict situation, but where the conflict still flared up at times. So there were serious security issues. Same in Palestine, which is obviously an always conflict situation, sadly. So security was a big issue in both of those assignments, while it isn't here. I mean, I appreciate the efforts of the UN to keep me safe here, but frankly, I've never felt any threats, work-related threats. The most dangerous thing for me was to cross Sihanouk Boulevard at 6 o'clock in the evening before they established the traffic lights. So I think that's probably one of the major differences. The other ones, I already touched on the cultural thing, which was not so big an issue in Kosovo, bigger one in Palestine. And obviously, the work in Palestine was very different. I wasn't working as a judge there. I was working in rule of law development, which I found very, very interesting for various reasons, specifically because it allows you some creativity. You're not so much boxed in by the law, which is what, applying the law is what you do as a judge.
Yeah, following up on that a bit, we'd like to talk a little more about your experience in Palestine working with the policing criminal justice system. So thinking about the ECCC and its context and mission, how would you say here in Cambodia the ECCC has supported the rule of law? And perhaps you could talk a bit about your time in Palestine as well.
Well, when it comes to the ECCC, I want to narrow your question down from the overall concept of rule of law, which is, of course, a much bigger concept, to capacity building in the field of criminal justice. Because that's what we makes it easier comparable to Palestine, too, because that's what we did in Palestine. Basically, it was about capacity building, not only, but also. Now, it's not the mandate of the it's not in the mandate of the ECCC to build capacity, for better or worse. There are no funds for it, because it's not in the mandate. There was no time provided for it. What I mean is, when you are sitting in court during trials, I can tell you that keeps you occupied not only 7 days a week, not only 5 days a week, but 7 days, including the Saturdays and Sundays, so there isn't too much time to be involved in capacity building. So I guess the impact that the ECCC had, hopefully, at least on the court system, is more indirect, meaning through the people who worked with us, through the people from the national courts who worked with us as the international judges, specifically the young ones. There were also private initiatives, well, private. I have, for instance, and other colleagues too, frequently lectured at university for prosecutors, for judges. I've enjoyed it very much. In order to get a bit of an idea of where I was, I first of all went to normal courts and tried to be incognito, which you can never really be because you obviously stand out as a foreigner, but they didn't know who I was. And I asked for a couple of copies of verdicts. The one thing that struck me was that at least at that time, verdicts were basically not reasoned. Nor were, for instance, vital decisions like detention decisions. I've always wondered at the time what you did as an appeals court with a verdict which wasn't reasoned. So one of the very fundamental things which at least I have preached again and again and again is you have to reason verdicts and for various reasons. And I think, and not only me, others too, I think that's something which, if what I hear from the national side is correct, has changed. Another thing, while precedent is not necessarily legal precedent, as important in civil law systems as in common law systems, it obviously helps if you know what your Supreme Court or your appeals court has said to a legal question. And a couple of years ago, the National Site has started a legal database which collects these decisions, which I think is also another impact the ECCC might have had in this connection.
Yeah, thank you. That's all very interesting. Thinking a little more about your time at the ECCC broadly, are there any other lessons learned or best practices or recommendations that you would have for future courts or future international tribunals?
Well, I think for future international tribunals, one of the first things has nothing directly to do with the court, but with the overall approach to dealing with mass crimes in the context of an international tribunal. International tribunals or courts of any description usually have a limited personal jurisdiction. They deal with the most responsible. Yeah? The language is slightly different, but they deal with a couple of people at the top. Now, there is a couple of issues with this approach. It's understandable because it would go beyond the capacity, both when it comes to funds and to time of courts to deal with everything. But, and that's a problem, there is a bit of a tendency that this distorts the history because it's never only a couple of people at the top who are responsible for what happens in the context of mass crimes, and the context are very different. They always depend on lots and lots and lots of people cooperating. If they never show up, if they are never held to account, either by a domestic system or in any other way, you get this impression that they are basically acquitted because they haven't been selected as the senior leaders or most responsible. I think what should be done if future courts are established is to find a way to hold these lower level perpetrators accountable. Now, either through the national system or where that doesn't function, through informal mechanisms. Many countries have informal mechanisms. That can be truth-telling, that can be various other things. I don't think there is a one fit for all. But I think there needs to be a need in order to have a comprehensive picture of what happened, that accountability is to make it clear, a need to make it clear that accountability is not restricted to a couple of people at the top. That's a tall order to establish something like this. Needs a lot of creativity, a lot of adapting to local conditions, ideally coordination. Those two processes should never jeopardize each other. But I think it's something which should happen for a second reason. One complaint we have frequently heard here from victims is, well, but my neighbor, who was actually the one who killed my uncle, yeah, is still living there. Nobody's asking him any questions. They didn't know the people at the top who gave the orders, who devised the policies. They knew the person next doors, who was the actual killer. This is an example, obviously. And nothing happens to them. So this is this is far from ideal. Also, when it comes to how victims perceive that justice has been done. This is how they were impacted. On the more, well, an obvious recommendation, if you can, don't wait so long. 30 years after the fact, trials are a real challenge. There's a reason why most countries have statutes of limitation. It's really difficult to deal with evidence which is 30 years old. Memories that are 30 years old change over time. Forensic evidence becomes more and more difficult. Getting documents becomes more and more difficult. So if possible, do it as close as possible to the time when the crimes were actually committed. When it comes to, and this is about mass crimes, I think there needs to be an understanding that the size of cases needs to be managed. What has happened in various national and international courts is that they've given in to the temptation to cover as comprehensively as possible, legally, historic events which have spent years and gone over large geographical areas. If you want to do this, then you need decades to work through it legally. It has forced us at the ECCC to sever indictments into workable chunks. And I think this is one of the challenges for future courts to actually say, and to make a conscious decision to say, yes, this is not dealing with the whole issue. We are concentrating on this and this, and try and get trials done in a halfway short period of time or decent period of time, as opposed to going on forever, which makes evidence not easier and people impatient. That's not an easy balance to be struck, because very often these international trials are also supposed to provide a historic lesson, which they can never completely do. That must be very, very clear. Well, when it comes to legal framework, the important thing is to establish a legal framework which is geared towards mass crimes. Civil law systems are not a good idea. I'm not going into a detailed description of what the civil law system is, but it basically amounts to a long, confidential pretrial phase, which is ideally followed by a short public trial. While the common law system is the other way around, that's a very simplified description. Now, that doesn't work for international crimes, because they are supposed to play out on open stage, and the open stage is the trial stage. So what we had here was long confidential pretrial and a long public trial, which replicated many of the things that happened during pretrial. So it's the worst of two systems. So generally, I would say a civil law system is not well placed to deal with these kind of crimes. Oath. Very important when it comes to the structure of the court is the funding. Funding a court via donors is not a good idea. Yeah? First of all, all of these courts take longer than was originally envisaged. Now, donor interests, donors are countries. Countries' interests change over time. New challenges come up, budgets are limited, they lose interest in further funding a court. In our case, this has led to funding shortages, which has left specifically Cambodian staff, yeah, without a salary for months. It has led to strikes of translators at the time, to staff at the time. Strike means you lose time, which means it gets more expensive again. So that needs to be done by assessed contributions, which would also ensure that more of you in ownership, which might be a good idea in most of those cases. That's very important, because in the worst case, donors might try to even influence, to a degree, proceedings. And that's obviously something which should not happen. Yeah. One other thing, and that's close to my heart, is if you want victims to participate, then decide on this from the very beginning, then fund it. And I'll give a very short overview on what has happened at the ECC, because it's an example of what shouldn't happen in any other court. First of all, there are only two international or internationalized courts who allow victims participation. One is the ICC, the other is the ECCC. It's quite interesting to see how this started, because it's a bit of a weird story. Victims participation was not foreseen by the parties to the agreement, which is why it wasn't funded. Funds were not foreseen for it. So how did it come in? Well, there is one mention in the ECCC law, possibly a reductional oversight, yeah, which mentions an appeal for victims. Well, if you give a victim a right to appeal, you have to allow him to participate in proceedings. And since victims in the traditional civil law system participate as civil parties, civil parties were considered the way how victims should participate. Now, civil party participation is full party participation. That means you are basically litigating civil claims in a criminal court. That's something you can do with one, two, or three victims. That's something you can obviously not do with a large number of victims. That was quite clear from the beginning. One of the issues when we drafted the rules was that common law judges are not familiar with this system. So they said, well, yeah, suggest something. Many of the civil law judges said, oh my God, yeah, the mere idea to litigate hundreds and hundreds of claims, it proved to be thousands in the end, but that will derail the court. So from the very beginning, the traditional civil law system was changed. Then the Doig case happened. We had a bit less than 100 civil parties. And even with those 100 who participated in four groups, it became clear that won't work, specifically not for a case, and that became clear at the time, which will have close to 4,000 civil parties, because that was case two. So we had basically two options. Either we scrap the whole civil party system, because otherwise the proceedings would have been driven against the wall, or we change it in a way which allows victims to participate in some way, but without derailing the process. And so over the years, over the next 2 years, we changed the systems, I think, five times. We basically changed it while we were going, which is one of the reasons for some of the deficiencies of the system. The changes, without going into details, basically were in three areas. One was participation, the second was representation, the third was reparation. Now, since we developed it while we are going, obviously nobody knew about it. The NGOs, at the beginning, the NGOs who were very much involved in application for civil parties didn't know the background. The victims themselves didn't know about it. So expectations were not managed well, couldn't have been managed well, arguably. Now, one of the big problems, or one of the interesting things for me, was that it was extremely difficult when we developed this new system to get away from the label civil parties. Civil parties is a certain legal concept. What we have developed here is so far removed from traditional civil parties that I actually suggested to skip the term, not pretend they are any longer participating as civil parties, but make it clear and say this is a sui generis system of victims' participation. Why not? That was impossible. So I've learned all about the power of labels that you can possibly want to know. But again, in the future, if a court decides to have victims' participation, it needs to be very clear what form of participation, what form this participation should take. It needs to be funded, and there needs to be clear outrage. Victims need to understand very clearly how they can participate, how they will be represented, and what, if any, kind of reparation they can expect. Otherwise, it's counterproductive.
Great. Well, thank you so much for all of that. I hope future courts are listening to this, because that sounds like a lot of really helpful advice for them. So thinking about some of the activities in the courts and keeping in mind what has and has not been released to the public, can you recall any accused or survivor stories that you've heard that really resonated with you at the ECCC?
I've been asked many times by people how I could sit through days, weeks, months, and years of statements of specifically victims who told horrendous stories. To back up perhaps a bit, as a judge, also in the domestic system, you have to learn at an early stage to put a screen between you and horrible things that have happened, be it suffering, be it actions. You look, if you listen to a victim who tells you how it has suffered, you listen to the victim through a legal screen, if you want it like that. Now, that sounds a bit cold, and unempathetic, but I think it's the only option if you want to stay objective and professional, and also if you want to keep your mental health. If you allow all of those emotional onslaught to come directly down to you, you probably better look for another. You'll have to look for another job pretty soon. Now, so even before I came here, I've both in the domestic system and in Kosovo heard lots of horrible stories, and it's quite interesting for what reason some stories resonate more with you than others. We discussed it with colleagues. It has to do, I think, with the personal background. So I'll pick out one and then perhaps explain why it resonated more than others. It was the story of a woman, very young at the time, who was married and had two very small kids and was evacuated from Phnom Penh. During the evacuation, one of the kids, both kids were basically babies, very young, got lost in the turmoil, never to be seen again. The second child starved a couple of weeks later in her arms. Her husband was, she was separated from her husband, never saw him again. She ended up in a cooperative where she was working. She survived. Later, it was very difficult to reintegrate into life because she had come from a, I think you would probably call it, middle-class background. Family had basically disappeared, so she was now living in the countryside. Remarriage was very difficult, both for cultural reasons, but also because it was unclear for a while if the husband was perhaps still somewhere around. So she had managed to survive, and she told us about not only about the Khmer Rouge period, but also about how this had impacted on her life ever since. I guess the reasons why it resonated so much for me was, first of all, the way how she told the story. It wasn't dramatic. She wasn't crying. She was basically telling facts, terrible facts, in a matter-of-fact verse, which it, in a matter-of-fact voice, which I think for me probably made it more, I don't know, more terrible than if she would have started crying or so. The second issue, which became very clear to me, is for her, the Khmer Rouge period hadn't ended in 79. It had been with her all her life, had impacted on her whole life. And I think the third reason was personal. She was basically the same age as I was. I think the difference was 2 days or so. So the birth date obviously caught me. And I guess the issue was, could have been me if I hadn't been fortunate enough to be born in another place.
Yeah, that is, I can certainly imagine how that would resonate. Thank you for sharing that with us. So thinking forward a little bit, what do you think the major impacts of the ECCC will be on Cambodian society, both today and, say, 20 years in the future?
Well, on society, I think the major impact is that the silence has been broken. If nothing else, this court has made people talk about it. It's not a Cambodian speciality that in the aftermath of historic events of that magnitude, which engulfed basically the whole population, where basically everybody has been either a victim or a perpetrator, people don't really want to talk much about it. Bury it somewhere, get on with your life, start something new. That's not specific for Cambodia, but it also happened in Cambodia. It was also, at one time, there was even a word for it, policy-wise. Now, the ECCC has clearly reopened this discussion. I think one of the interesting things is, or one of the tangible things, is that a couple of years ago, the history of the Khmer Rouge was made part of the curriculum of schools. So young people are now told about it. And one would hope that as long as the people who have lived through the periods are still alive, so their parents or grandparents, they actually ask them. Now, I understand that this isn't easy in this society where you don't challenge your parents. And your parents might have been perpetrators or victims or both. There are cases where they were both. but at least the option is there to open this dialogue. Now, when it comes to in 20 years, that's of course very difficult to predict. It will very much depend on what is done with the legacy of the court, what is done with all the material which has been collected and which has so far only been looked at through a legal angle, which is much too narrow an angle. This is a treasure trove for historians, sociologists, psychologists, medical people. There is such a lot of material to look into. And, you know, it really strikes me that a recurring question, if you talk to young people, is, oh my God, I don't understand, how could Cambodians kill Cambodians? Well, look at the case file, yeah? You might get a couple of answers about how extreme ideologies impact on people, what collectivism means, how you make people, how you pitch people against each other to the degree where another category is not considered human anymore. There are techniques behind that, which are not unique to here. I mean, there is this famous saying that you better learn history, otherwise you might be forced to repeat it. So I would hope that in 20 years, what we have collected here has given rise to further research and perhaps a couple of answers to the questions which are asked by many Cambodians.
Before we wrap up, is there anything we haven't talked about that you think is important or that you would like us to know?
At the moment, I can't think of anything.
Okay.
So I leave it to you to Great. Clarify what else you think should be clarified.
No, I think that you've given us a lot of really useful information. So if you're good, we're good. So thank you again for speaking with us. We
you're
really
welcome.
Appreciate it.